Good morning, everyone.
You're all welcome.
But the chief of staff, why is Helen like Denigan Kaka? What was Helen?
You're welcome, Dr. Pakati, and your team. Members, don't think there's a need for us to be introducing ourselves. Is there a need? No need. Okay. Without any waste of time, I'm going to hand over to the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation to quickly give us a briefing on the implementation and consolidated reports on citizen-based monitoring and frontline service delivery monitoring results. And also they will be giving us a briefing on annual development indicators. I don't know if they want to package them together or we should deal first with the first item, then later we take the second item. You will do them together. Okay. Right. You're welcome. You may introduce yourself and then proceed with the presentation. Okay. The platform is
good morning, Chairperson, honorable members. My name is Bernadette Leon. I am from the Department of Performance Monitoring, Evaluation and Planning. I'm the head of Frontline Service Delivery Monitoring. I will be doing, starting with an input on the unannounced monitoring visits that we do and how the program works and the results. And then Jonathan Tim next to me is the Director of Citizen-Based Monitoring. He's one of the newest projects that we have, and he will give an input on Citizen-Based Monitoring, the pilot. The two projects are quite related, so we could do the one presentation after the other. And then have a discussion on that. Maybe as a start to say, in the department, we have three related programs which we call together Frontline Service Delivery Monitoring. The first is the unannounced monitoring visits, where we try to improve the self-monitoring by departments of the quality of service delivery at frontline facility levels. And frontline facilities, we talk about police stations, clinics, home affairs. And for that project, we go to Cabinet every year. We produce an annual results report, and we present that to Cabinet. The last annual report was presented in March of 2014, and we are at the moment completing the visits, doing the analysis, and by June 2015, in a few months' time, at the very latest, the next report will. So, the second project is the citizen-based monitoring, which is a much more in-depth engagement with citizens about their experiences of frontline facilities. Jonathan will present on that. And the third one is the presidential hotline, which is really an apex complaint system where we offer a service to the public to lodge their complaints, their queries, about service delivery, and we won't talk about that project in detail. So the unannounced monitoring visits, as I said, the aim of this project is to strengthen the M&E practices of field-level managers and their supporting decision makers in head office. So when we work with or we monitor SASA facilities, the idea is to work in such a way that the head office SASA officials, regional SASA officials, and the facility level officials have an opportunity to be exposed to improved monitoring that they should be doing themselves by engaging with us. We also anticipate that often monitoring findings are not acted on, and so the methodology we follow is that we present the findings to the top management of the sector when we do the monitoring visits. On the one hand, so that they have the findings. And secondly, we also revisit some of the facilities to track progress We do that also to model to departments that unless you present findings to top management, unless you revisit continuously, there's a likelihood that findings will not be acted on, and that's why we do those two things. We implement this project with all 9 offices of the Premier. So when we are in the field as a monitoring team, the monitoring team always consists of a DPME official or two and an office of the Premier official or two. And the reason we do that is that over time, as monitoring systems mature, ideally offices of the Premier would be very active in the field and do this type of dipstick monitoring of frontline as part of their normal work. And we would possibly do a smaller sample and they would be a lot more active. That's why we do the program with them. Ideally, they would see that this is valuable work that they should be doing on an ongoing basis. The role that DPME plays in this regard is that we design and maintain the monitoring tools that we use in the front line. We analyze findings and we report to cabinet and to national sector departments. And as I said, the monitoring visits are conducted jointly. We are often asked, why don't we do the monitoring with the national sector department? For example, when we monitor a police station, why don't we do it with the police? And the reason for doing that is that we wanted to be seen as an kind of external, almost an audit of their own monitoring on the one hand. And secondly, when they are present, it does affect the findings, the feedback that citizens give, the feedback that staff will receive, most definitely gets affected when you bring the leadership of that sector in. So the steps that we follow, we assess, as I said, we do a questionnaire, we interview citizens, we interview staff, we ourselves give a rating and a score, and we produce a scorecard with an improvement plan. We communicate feedback. We advise on improvements. Given that we are not, as DPME, often sector specialists, we are not policing specialists, we are not social development specialists or health specialists, but we do find that often the things that are broken at frontline, we sometimes have a very simple idea, so we can see very simple ways that they can be fixed. So we would facilitate and try and bring people together to conscientize them about possible solutions and to get them to act on it. And then we assess improvements every year. What are we actually monitoring? We are monitoring quality of service delivery. And quality of service delivery, the performance areas that we measure is queue management and waiting times, complaints management, cleanliness and comfort, dignified treatment, and the ones that are listed there about. So it's 8 key performance areas, and each of those have a couple of questions that we use to assess what the conditions are. And then what are the types of facilities that we are monitoring? Those are the 8 types of facilities. Of course, there are maybe other types that we could be monitoring, but when we started this, the focus was very much on not, doing a million assessments or large number of assessments, but be very targeted about the types of places we go to, because we wanted very quickly to show results, and we wanted to show how those results should be used. So if we spend 3 years just doing assessments, because there's most probably 50,000 facilities we could be monitoring, we would not have got to the point where we are now, where we've been able to extract very quickly some very good evidence of what works and what does not work at facility level. And we can very quickly start pushing the system to respond to those results. Otherwise, we stay just in assessment mode if we just do assessments and we don't analyze and we don't act on them. So to date, given that the program started in June 2011, we have monitored 650 facilities up to December last year. For each facility, a scorecard is produced and reported. and we produce a consolidated annual report for each sector department, and I can show examples. It's not in the presentation. These are big data reports. I have examples of them here on my computer, and I can bring them up if members are interested in. So, for example, for the National Police Management, for the National Health Management Team, every mid-year and every year we will give them a very detailed report of where we've been, what we found per facility, what the actions were that was agreed on, and what we would like them to focus on. Improvement facilitation and improvement monitoring. Of the 650, last year we re-monitored 77 to assess if improvements have taken place. We do not have the capacity to re-monitor all 650. Improvement monitoring is quite intensive, so we choose the ones that perform the poorest, and we go back to them. The outcomes of that improvement monitoring, we also presented to departments and also to cabinet, as I said, in March. And the improvement monitoring that we're currently busy with, about 123 facilities, they will be ready, it will be ready in June this year, with the report on that. And in the 4 years that we've implemented this program, we've contributed, I think, to a stronger strategic focus by responsible departments on the performance of frontline facilities. Most departments that we are monitoring now are improving their planning and their monitoring of facilities. We can say with confidence, I think, that especially justice, health, and to some extent the police, 4 years ago there was very little strategic consultation about the frontline facilities. And now it is very much part of their programs. If you look at their strategic plans, their annual performance plans, you would see quite a big focus on the performance of the frontline facilities, which you might not have seen a few years ago in their programs. Then the next slide are just samples of what do these scorecards look like and what do they say. This is an example of one scorecard for a SASSA facility, Mid-Vaal SASSA facility. So there are 8 key performance areas, like location, accessibility, visibility, and signage. So for location and accessibility, we get 3 views. We will ask citizens, what do they score it on a score to 1 to 1 is poor, 4 is very good. And in this case, citizens have scored at 3, which is good. The monitor, which is us, we give it our own score. We scored that it's fair, and the staff has scored that it's fair. And in this specific scorecard, we will see that queue management and waiting times, citizens have scored it very poorly, whereas staff thought it was fair. And complaints management and compliments management has performed the poorest. What is useful about this is a very simple tool of getting data about if you need to focus your energy on one thing to fix in the facility, what could possibly be your entry point? And you choose it not based on what you think is important sitting in the office in Pretoria, but on what the staff said and on what the citizens said is important to them. And in this case, compliments and queue management is seen to be something that is important to both the people who are using the facility and to the staff, and then we also thought it might be something that would be useful. So the thing that I've just shown is part A of the scorecard. This is part 2 of the scorecard, which is an action plan that we agree on with the facility, and then part the last part of the scorecard is a photograph of what we have found, and the photographs are quite a powerful tool to illustrate to people what the conditions were like, good and bad, and also to illustrate what good looks like. We are very good at describing what is bad, this is bad, 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 but sometimes it's good to show visually. When we say clean, this is what clean looks like. So that's why we use photographs. very easy for civil servants nowadays because most of us have smartphones, sometimes subsidized by government, and so it should be easy for us as monitoring to take these kinds of photographs when we do monitoring in the field, and so we're also encouraging that. How do we analyze all of this data? This is one example of the annual report that we produce in March, where we will say for each of the sectors that we've monitored, DLTCs is licensed centers. So for licensed centers, of all the licensed centers that we've monitored, the sample that we've monitored, what did we find in the country are the major issues? And in this case, we would see that complaints management, again, is possibly a weak area. And then we can do a comparison in this. And we also find that health facilities and courts have often scored very well, on average, where we have monitored. We're also able to give each province, Office of the Premier, are the people we work through. We would be able to present to them scorecards like this that tells them what are the general findings of the facilities we monitored in their province. What are the areas that is doing well and what's not doing so well. So in this specific case, understanding that it's all depending on the sample size, for example, the Northern Cape and Mpumalanga and in Limpopo. Overall, the facilities we monitored scored on average a 3, whereas in the Free State and Gauteng, the scores were slightly lower. This is just more details of the kind of the summary scorecard that you're able to produce for each facility. So if managers want a very quick snapshot of you know, what is going on in the secondary school, in that specific secondary school, you can get a very, very simple little scorecard of that without having to get very complicated with us. This is an example of how we do improvement monitoring analysis. So we're able to start tracking now because the sample size is getting bigger and bigger. In year one, when we went to a few of the DLTCs, what was the average score? And in this case, it was 1.83, which is quite poor. In year two, when we went, what was the score? 2.13, slight improvement, still not a 3. And in year three, 2.44, very high level. Is it generally an improvement trend, or is it not improving, or is it regressing? And other than actually producing results that should then be acted on, what we're also doing is almost modeling to a department like National Transport. This is the type of analysis you should be doing. This is the type of data you could be collecting very easily. And this is how you would analyze it. And then this is how you could possibly act on the findings. Without waiting for us to do it. But in the meantime, every year we will bring you results. But it would be then good if you proactively do this kind of monitoring all the time. And as I said earlier on, that message definitely has been successful with, for example, justice and health, and then SAPS as well, who have now have teams who do this kind of monitoring themselves. I can also say with National Department of Transport, in the first year, Transport would have said, well, we don't really have responsibility for what's happening at facility level because of the agency agreement with provinces, with municipalities. And then after a year, they realized that they do have some responsibility, and then realized that they've never regulated quality norms and standards for DLTCs. They had norms they've regulated how the business must work, but they didn't regulate the quality of service delivery. So last year they actually issued regulations, norms and standards for quality service delivery, which we think is a very positive thing. And then in the future, when they have an agency agreement with the municipality to run a DLTC, those standards can be included in the contract, so that if the municipality doesn't adhere to those standards, they could lose their agency arrangement. And we think that is a positive thing. These are all examples of analysis. And a message that we have been giving to departments, if you want to really be on top of quality of service delivery improvements at facility level, there are a number of questions they should be asking themselves, and ideally they should be able to respond to this positively, otherwise their chances of improving will be challenged. The first thing is whether they have norms and standards in place, whether those norms and standards are realistic and monitored daily. For example, are there realistic facility level standards for cleanliness or waiting times? And then are they monitoring against this? What we have found often is that we might be monitoring cleanliness, but actually there's never been norms and standards set for cleanliness. So we're monitoring against a shifting, basically monitoring against perception, what I think is clean, what the citizen thinks is clean, which of course is a challenge. So we're asking, do you have standards of what poor cleanliness would be or good cleanliness? And if you don't have that, please develop that, because then it would be easy to know what we are trying to hit. The second question we asked, whether their regional offices and their head office, whether they collect regular data from facilities, whether they do trend analysis, and whether that data is influencing their budgets and their systems and their processes. If they can't take that positively, it means that maybe the planning and the budgeting is not being influenced by data from the field. And ideally, one should make your planning and budgeting decisions on what the conditions are in the field. Are the delegations at facility level appropriate to enable the manager to be held accountable? This is something that managers often say at facility level: I'm being held accountable, but I don't have the power to make decisions. I don't manage the cleaners. It might be someone in Polokwane that has a contract. I don't manage the lease, because the leaseholder is another department. So there's a lot to be done around making sure that facility managers have the right delegation so that they can make decisions and get things done. The last question we ask departments is whether they collect regular citizen and user feedback at facility level, and whether they use that to effect full improvement. We ask them that question because our results show that that often doesn't happen, and because of that we started this project around citizen-based monitoring, where we're wanting to support departments of how they should actually be doing this to involve citizens more in the findings. And then since the program has started, we mobilized very quickly to get into the field. All the provinces are now part of the program and cooperating with us. We have developed high-level working relationships with key national departments, such as Justice and Home Affairs. We've been less successful initially with transport. That's changed. It took us, I think, 2 years. But now we do have regular engagements with them, and then education. Of course, the more complex the roles and responsibilities are when it's a national function like Home Affairs. Home Affairs very much is in control. If something is broken, they can fix it from the top. With shared functions like education and the DLTC, it's often a bit more complicated to bring to action some of the findings. And then there are three slides right at the end, which is not in the pack, which I thought, if the chairperson will allow me, it's just three systemic issues that I thought was useful. And I remembered a bit late that we included this in the cabinet report, and I thought I would just mention it. The first is about, I've already mentioned that there is a positive shift, we think, about managing facility-level performance as a strategic priority. Health definitely leads the way in this regard, and joining them over the last few years is Home Affairs, SASSA, and Justice. SASSA, with their very limited resources, we find to be extremely responsive when we find things in the field that are just unacceptable. And we call head office, they try, they're very, very responsive, and we always thank them for that, knowing that they have, you know, resource challenges as well. The second issue, systemic issue we wanted to mention is public works and line department collaboration that is needed for facility leasing arrangements. Some line departments find the way those powers and functions are allocated between public works, say if we take Home Affairs, public works, Home Affairs, they find that to be a risk to their business. They are accountable for how the Home Affairs office runs, but sometimes they are not the lease, they don't hold the lease, and they might not always be responsible. So poor lease management and dilapidating infrastructure, unclear roles and responsibilities for the management of cleaning and security contracts often impacts negatively on the overall performance of facilities. And we think that maybe this is a good time for us to start re-looking at those powers and functions and see if it's still appropriate, if there may be a slightly different model, especially for departments that have now quite good track records. Like, I mean, we could say that Home Affairs and Justice over the last few years with clean audits, very complicated businesses, but achieving clean audits, we think they might be able to cope with more powers and for lease management and facility management than other departments do. Lastly, complaint handling. So we do think that it's very clear from all of the monitoring that we've done of these facilities that there is a need to strengthen accountability of departments for complaints handling. We feel that firstly we have to congratulate ourselves that over the last few years we have made huge strides in putting the front end infrastructure in place. Every single facility has a complaints register or a complaints box. You will not find a facility who does not have that. And that, I think, is positive. Now the next level is to make sure those systems are functional, that people trust them, that people are using them, and that there is accountability, meaning we report back to citizens about their complaints and what we have done about it at facility level. And so we think there is some work that is required for us to go to the next level. DPSA have developed a framework on complaints management. They are actually the department who really has a policy responsibility for complaints management. Maybe this is time for regulations based on that framework about making sure departments give feedback to citizens on the complaints that is received so that citizens start using it more because they can see evidence that when you drop something in that box, there is it gets given attention. Someone phones you and say, you know, thank you for lodging your complaint, and this is what we're planning to do about it. Thank you, Chairperson. I am now going to, if you will allow me, to go to the CBM.
responsibility in DPME is for a program called citizen-based monitoring. As mentioned, it's a new focus area which attempts to respond to some of the to a gap in terms of the involvement of citizens, ordinary citizens, in the monitoring of the performance of government, and in particular the need to build partnerships at a community level around the delivery of services. So if I may just give an overview of the presentation which I would like to make. I want to touch on the policy commitment to citizen-based monitoring, look at the thematic areas of DPME's citizen-based monitoring program, and then to review the piloting of the citizen-based monitoring. We've been for the past just over a year been in working with the South African Police Service, SASSA, Department of Social Development, and Department of Health to pilot an approach to citizen-based monitoring in 18 facilities across the country. And then just to present some emerging findings from this work that we're doing, and touch on plans for expanding over the next 12 months. Just in August 2013, Cabinet approved a framework for strengthening citizen government partnerships for monitoring frontline service delivery. It broadly frames the policy environment in which this work is taking place. It's based in the Constitution, in a lot of the policy work from the early days of the democracy, and it describes as well approaches that could be followed by government departments in order to give strengthen the voice of ordinary people in the way services are monitored. In approving the framework, Cabinet required that all government departments involved in service delivery to the public should adjust their monitoring and evaluation practices and frameworks to incorporate the views and experiences of citizens on service delivery. And we're also providing an annual progress report to Cabinet on progress made. So briefly, the framework defines citizen-based monitoring as an approach to monitoring government performance that focuses on the experiences of ordinary citizens in order to strengthen public accountability and drive service delivery improvements. It requires citizens to be active participants in shaping what is monitored, how the monitoring is done, and what interpretations and actions are derived from the data. I think the emphasis here is that monitoring data should be used at the point at which it's gathered. So I think what is quite unique in terms of the citizen-based monitoring approach is that the emphasis is on the facility or service and community where that service is being delivered. So there is it's not primarily about getting an assessment of how service delivery is being conducted across an entire sector or the country, but it is focusing on how monitoring data can be used to drive service delivery improvements at a local level, and then obviously providing systemic insights and insights into where improvements are required systemically. But the focus is at a local level. And this idea of active citizenry is obviously a key idea in the National Development Plan. And I think the work that we've been doing in the field really speaks to a possible route to contribute to this development of an active citizenry in partnership with a capable and developmental state. Our program as a department is defined by these three focus areas. The first is around developing approaches and tools, and this pilot that we are implementing across the country is a core focus for that. The second area that is really critical to making this data work to improve service delivery is techniques and approaches of turning data into change. I think a lot of the monitoring we have traditionally done has resulted in insights and analysis, but the practice of how to turn data into change systemically and at a local level is really what's critical. So that is an important focus of the pilot's intentions and the capacity and practices that we are developing through this approach. And then importantly as well is how does the monitoring of government services by citizens achieve in building social cohesion? How does the conversation between civil society, both at an organized national level and at a community level, and government result in improvements to the challenges, not just an increasingly adversarial situation on the ground? So there is reference to citizen-based monitoring in Outcome 14, Social Cohesion. A focus for DPME's program is also exploring the creation of platforms for dialogue with organized civil society in the state. I think we all agree that a lot of the discourse is defined by confrontation and adversarial adversary, I should say. Just a brief overview of this pilot that I've referred to. We started really in two places, in Putaritshaba in the Free State and Msinga in KwaZulu-Natal. And this first phase was conducted around four services, those ones I mentioned, police, social development, so focused primarily on the support to NPOs and social work, Department of Health, so the Church of Scotland Hospital and Putaritshaba Clinic, and the police stations. We then refined, based on the experiences we had in the field and working with the various departments, we refined a phase two model, which we then implemented from August last year in a Burgersfort in Limpopo, in Temba in Tshwane, and in Jubiton in Northwest. Again, we've just completed that cycle of this model, and I'll describe the model in a little bit more detail now. And we are now in preparations for the third cycle of prototyping or developing this approach in the remaining four provinces, so the three Capes and Mpumalanga. This pilot phase comes to a conclusion in September this year, where we will then focus on a strategy for scaling up what has worked. And I think what's important to bear in mind is this is not a one-size-fits-all type of approach. It's locally based. It requires the ownership and take-up of both community and government. So for different sectors, different departments, different types of facilities, different types of communities, the approaches could be quite different. The model that we've been piloting through this action learning approach identifies four steps. The first is a step that we have titled listening, which is really just getting various stakeholders on board in a particular community and laying the foundations for a community survey. So this model is based on a survey of approximately 1,000 community members for each of the services that we're focusing on. So 1,000 citizen interviews for the police service, 1,000 interviews for the health service in a particular community, etc. The surveys are conducted by a team of community members who are trained, given a training, and there's an emphasis on this experience for the community members. There's a day is set aside for debriefing. There's a daily debriefing. So there's an acknowledgement that this experience for local community members is a contribution in and of itself into building the culture of active citizenry. Then what follows from the survey is the production of a report on that particular service in a community. So let's take, for example, the Jubberton Police Station will have a report that will bring together the responses of 800 or 1,000 citizens. It's data that is perceptions, but it is statistically significant enough for anyone to need to take those perceptions seriously. So the discussions that we have with a particular management team or community representatives often focus on, well, is this data, is it facts? And it's not facts, it's perceptions, but it's perceptions that will shape the reality in which that service is delivered. So what we do, the model takes that data and focuses on the third step, which is really the most exciting and challenging step, which is turning that data into a commitment for improvement. So we work with a team of management, staff, and community organizations. So, for example, with the policing function, we work with the CPF, so the formal community representative structures. We'll work with the clinic committee. We'll work with the ward committee to, first of all, identify what is this data saying about problem areas, and then what are the root causes of these particular problems, and then what is the response collectively or individually from the service or from the community. And this week, which we call Dizen Dikuve or Nkutre Kiko Utre in English, listen to me so that I can listen to you, is about building a dialogue around data and improvement. This culminates in a community feedback session on the Friday. And then the last part of this process is monitoring of the commitments that were made from this process. And this involves monitoring from a number of different levels. The key area of the new space is how to enable monitoring by citizens of these commitments. So we've been exploring opportunities like community media, community radio in particular, the role of council, the local government council, of ward committees, of NGOs. But there's obviously an important role for DPME as a national department in the presidency to look at where there are systemic issues. There's a role for the sector departments involved to monitor the commitment. So there's multi-level monitoring that goes on. Just to give you a sense of the kind of data that we've gathered, through the pilot we've conducted 12,000 citizen interviews. We've produced these reports on each of the participating services and facilities. But the data, the survey that we've used, we've had a one-page rule, so the questions cannot exceed a single page of legible type. And they're very simple questions, rating issues that matter to citizens. So we've had a series of focus groups to determine in each sector what these issues are, as well as making sure that it talks to the monitoring system of a particular department. We have, most of them are closed-ended answers, but we do also get an open-ended response on what improvement would you most like to see in the facility, which provides quite interesting insights. I mentioned we conduct this root cause analysis with management staff and community representatives, which also give us as a collectively a very useful insight into the root causes of some of the challenges that are being experienced. And our work in many of these facilities have really allowed the people responsible for providing a service to really deepen their understanding to what is actually causing a problem. Most of the initial response from almost all management teams at facilities is we need more resources. But in probing the root causes, sometimes reveals that it's not so much the need for more resources, but for improved systems, improved efficiencies. So, for example, in one health facility, what they came to an amazing insight was that if they got their appointment system with their chronic patients to work effectively through involving the community members or the patients much more actively in running that appointment system, they would not have a need for a bigger waiting room or more staff. So with the existing resources working differently, they are able to provide an improved service, which is quite a radical shift in the conventional understanding of how services can be improved. We conduct the surveys in local languages, so we translate each of these surveys into the local language. And the surveyors are all local language speakers. I can give a number of examples of the improvements that have resulted from this process. It's unpredictable what will emerge as a priority issue. For example, in Dr. Kenneth Kawunda, the critical issue was the emergency services communication system with regard to ambulance services, and that was something that we collaborated as DPME with the Office of the Premier to assist the Provincial Treasury and Health Department to unlock a blockage in terms of procuring this communication system. Another systemic issue that we have identified with the police officials at a cluster and station level is the need to decentralize the maintenance system for police vehicles to a cluster level, and these are recommendations that we then make to the responsible departments and ministers. Just an example of the kind of information that is that comes from this process. You can see this is an assessment of community perceptions around the integrity of a local police service. So the questions, have you experienced police working with criminals in the community? Have you experienced police ignoring, mocking, or being rude to citizens? Not responding to calls for help? Asking for bribes, money, or favors? So you can see this data, which is purely perception-driven, and we discuss, you can imagine with police management there's sensitivity around this data, but the message we say is that you need to deal with the reality of the perception. If the perception is incorrect, you have a communication challenge. You need to communicate what you're doing differently. If the perception is driven by the reality of experience, then you need to change your management and operational activities. So it's one or the other, but you need to respond to it. When you have, for example, 37% of community members believing that police are corrupt, you need to respond to it. You can't ignore it. And you can see how the debate and discussion and analysis can really be very deep and meaningful when you're dealing with local community perceptions. They're not general. This is another interesting insight, and is a comparative. Some of the surveys, we ask staff members. So again, this is again focusing on police, but we do a similar thing for all the different services. We take critical indicators and ask the questions to community members, and ask the same question to staff. So here you can see a comparative view in answering the question, do the police hold public meetings to consult with the community? The community members, so the 800 community members, 70% of them had a negative response, either that the police are performing very poorly or poorly on this particular indicator. Now, I just want to emphasize that this is a particular police station. This is not policing in general, and I think it's important to realize the specific focus of this, it would not be accurate to then extrapolate across the country or the service in itself. But what is fascinating, I find here, is that the community have this view, which is strongly negative. The police officers in serving that same community rate themselves 54% positive, either good or very good. And then that yellow is a neutral response. So if you take neutral and positive, you've got an 87% positive response. And if you take neutral and negative, you've got an 89% negative. So the gap that is in between is the space where service delivery can improve. There's the opportunity lies in the gap. And we try through our emerging techniques, which we are wanting to embed in the government system, if we succeed in taking this to scale, in hard to understand why there's this big difference. And I think it's quite simple. Police officers are complying with what they are required to do in terms of public consultation. So they feel that they're performing very well in this area because they are doing what is required of them. So that is an output level measure. But this measure from the community is an outcome. Is what the police are doing resulting in what they want to do? And clearly there's a need for a tactical shift here. And then the discussion in that week of Nkutwe Kiku Utwe is about, so how do we do that? And it's around building agency at a facility level and also allowing us to identify systemic issues. This is analysis of the open comments. What improvement would you most like to see at this particular around policing in this area? And you can see here this gives us an indication of what priority issues are, because this is unprompted. So you can see improved responsiveness to calls for assistance is the number one issue in that community. Then increasing patrols, respect for people. And we're finding some of these issues across the country. They point to a similar concern. So once we have greater coverage, we'll be able to draw quite, I think, interesting insights into particular services. I just thought, for the sake of giving a texture, these are some pictures from some of the phase 2 sites. This is training the team of 40 community members in Pemba, in the municipal chambers. This is surveying out in the community. This is doing this root cause analysis. The orange cards are the problems that have been identified by the group, and that group consists of management, staff, and CPS, again, in the case of police. Here you have social development doing a similar exercise with community members. So it's a very interesting engagement. This is the clinic in Temba, identifying what the causes of these various problem areas. And then this process of Nkutwe Kiku Utwe or in Divendi Kuve results in, culminates in a community meeting. So we gather, but it's not a general community meeting. It's all of those people who have been involved in the process from the beginning. So if you are interviewed as part of the process, you are given a flyer to invite you to this feedback meeting. So we try and avoid that situation where it's an unstructured engagement. It's about a process. We use community radio. In this particular one, we use the community radio, the local community radio. They broadcast it to a broader audience. But the intention is to try and structure the process so that we build a kind of a partnership. A lot of the time, government officials find themselves in the firing line from a community, and it's the first time they're confronting some of these issues or having to respond. Whereas this particular process has brought government officials on board from the beginning and in a safer space to have the discussions and debates. So by the time they meet the broader community, they have responses as well as, they are able to actually talk about the way forward. Just some more images of this process. We provide certificates to this group of community surveyors. We're in discussion with COGTA to look at the possibility of scaling this community surveying through the community work program. So I think that's just to wrap up the activities up to September 2015, we will be working with the offices and departments of the Premier and the various provincial sector departments to identify the final four sites for the Phase 3 pilot. We're working with to develop an IT or a capacity to automate the generation of these facility-level reports, which should hopefully give us more capacity to do it at a greater scale. Again, I mentioned explorations with COGTA. We'll be doing a formal evaluation of the pilot in order to develop a five-year strategy for this. Thank you.
Lassen. The Minister for DPSA undertook a visit to frontline managers during the Public Service Month. We have not yet received the report, but are you in a position to share some light as to what are the challenges that were presented to you? Yeah, that's the only question that I have for now. But let me then allow members. I'll come again. I'll start from the blue. Okay.
Thank you,
in
Chair.
That order.
Chair, I'm having a lot of concerns or comments, but I promise I won't be long. I must say that, yes, I really do appreciate the presentation, and it seems that elsewhere or somewhere some people are busy working. But I must also emphasize the fact that we cannot deny that there are so many tools to do monitoring, evaluation, etc. And also there are a number of internal monitoring tools. I gathered some systems linked to ISO 9001, so African Bureau of Standards, and everything that goes alike. But I've also noticed that quite a number of times SASSA, Home Affairs, Police and Health were mentioned. Only once I heard the name of POCTA, where our biggest problems actually lie. And then it seems also, you know, that this body serves as a intelligence platform, be as it may for government, for the cabinet, or so, and it's also reporting on facilities. But I want a response in the question that is in question regarding it's a facility report. But I would like to link this together. The fact that it have to be a facility report stroke capacity. Because if your facility is not up to standard, then one have to have a look at the manpower itself. And also what was mentioned is that reports or results must actually serve to act on. Now, I want to visit the how part. If there's results, and in some cases that results are positive, in some cases negative, but when results are negative, what actually, you know, has been done in terms of intervention? Are we saying that, you know, are we saying that those who are in that specific positions, they're actually closer to the people? Are we saying that they understand what is service delivery, or do they not understand what is service delivery? So to me, it's not a question of a response to how can we better do the service delivery. The response is not resources. The response is as to whether those cadres in there, whether they understand it. They are closer to the people. They have their own processes, and what is the problem as far as assisting them in terms of intervention? I want to, and earlier on it has been so beautifully stated, so what? We have this result, so what? Now, in terms of the operation of this board, are they doing it on a program? I see provinces has been indicated for pilot projects to visit whatever they may be. There are some provinces that, in terms of their facilities and services, is in a disarray in this country, which is not mentioned there. Now, I want to know whether this body, when there's warning signals, when there's strikes, are they spiked by those warning signals to go in there to have a look and to engage with the communities what their problems are. If there are spikes by these happenings in and around the country, a case in point is the minister last week. Last week, the minister of Kokta had to go to a certain municipality. He was actually confronted with 50 shades of shame as far as that death is concerned in that specific community. So it's important for me that this body must have a bird's eye view of what is happening in this country to go in there before time. In Oudtshoorn, you'll find that for months there's no meetings that has been held. The minister was in Shekhar itself. The stuff that came out there has been reported for months, and we have a body of this nature which is not signaled this through the respective bodies in order for us as a government to act and see where best can we safeguard this. Then, in terms of the survey, it's a good soundbox. I appreciate it, but I'm curious to be supplied with the places where the survey has been done. If we say a police station, let's get the name of the police station so that we as public reps can go in there and see whether we can also assist in terms of our oversight role or as a committee to see and witness whether it is true what we experience there. And then I would also like to request a chair through you that the committee be supplied with the 650 facilities monitored to date on the unannounced monitoring visit. I would like to know where those facilities is, and then also the 77 facilities that were re-monitored. See, that is my problem. We monitored and we re-monitored. If we monitored, we must have a result, we must have a report, and we must have someone to go in and someone to intervene, and there must be interventions and proper interventions to see that, yes, we do have a body that really are appreciated by the entire community. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I've got four questions. The first is the implementation framework, which was mentioned in the second presentation about strengthening citizen government partnerships for frontline service delivery monitoring, recommends that you work with PALAMA to do training on citizen-based monitoring. I was wanting to know whether that in fact has taken place or what plans are in place for the recommendation to be acted upon. Then secondly, a broader question around whether you found there's been a lack of any political or bureaucratic support and commitment to citizen-based monitoring. You know, it's understandable that sometimes certain departments may interpret your findings as criticism. Has that been your experience? And if so, how do you mitigate that? Thirdly, have you found any particular social, cultural, and physical barriers that may prevent people, particularly vulnerable sectors of the community, elderly, disabled, youth, and so forth, from being comfortable or being able to give their real views on service delivery? And then finally, a question specifically on that police pilot. What are the indicators of police professionalism and improved service delivery? Are they informed by the National Development Plan, which talks about them at length? What are the time frames for that pilot, and how will your recommendations be acted upon by SAPS? What are the institutional mechanisms for ensuring that this follows through? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just one question. The idea of an active citizenry, I think everybody welcomes that because it is something that we need so that municipalities, provinces, national government will know what the people think and how they feel, and they do something about it before they end up in a Malamulele situation. But I come from communities where people generally are afraid of authority. They're intimidated by authority. Somebody goes to the clinic, they're sitting in line there, and they've been there for hours, and they are afraid to complain because at the hospital they're told if you complain, you are a graduate. You think you are a graduate. The words like graduate and stuff like that. Have you come across this kind of thing, and how do you handle these situations so that people can get over this hump to know that they are, in fact, the people for whom all these things are supposed to be done, and so when they complain, they are entitled to complain? Thank you.
Hi. Thanks, Chairperson. My first question is, in fact, interest is on the escalation of complaints or issues identified. Just like the first member has indicated, we know all of this, but then what happens next? Then my second one is, as government, we tend to disregard the needs of the manpower, which is the best resource to push service delivery. I was listening when you were doing this, the numbers on how do you rate and the staff rate themselves. I appreciate that the fact that you give them an opportunity and the space to say we can go as far. But when you identify that they cannot stretch themselves any further, how do you then escalate that issue? And do you also have a way of appreciating where they are producing more than the manpower that is there when you are going there? Because the issue that you are facing with and also DPSA has acknowledged it, is the issue of the loss of loss of morale. So when you see that there is a commitment of work well done, do you have a way of appreciating those that are giving more production than they should be or the number that they are? Well, that will then assist the service delivery and assist in your recommendations to other departments. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just quickly want to start off with a little story. I've heard of an elephant and a mouse crossing a bridge together, an old wooden bridge. And the mouse looked up to the elephant and said, "Oh, but aren't we shaking this bridge now?" Now, I've made a little calculation. 615 visits, 42 months, comes to 15 visits per month by your unit. If I divide the 15 visits by the 9 provinces, and if I then divide it by the 8 kinds of offices that you visit, it seems to me the chances that you will be visiting one of the 2,700 schools in the Western Cape is really slim. So now to say that you're shaking the government administration so that there's such an improvement in service delivery, I think is you've got as much faith as that mouse has got in your ability to bring about change. But then I also want to ask, what does the average cost per visit then work out to be? If you think of your annual budget divided by the 180 visits on average per annum. The second one is, well, it doesn't need to be to the nearest rand or even 10 rands. The second one is, you've mentioned who you make your reports available to, up to cabinet level. But I see you're not including things like school governing bodies, hospital boards, municipal managers, etc. And some of those entities, I think, they are the people that can really or should know what your findings are when you visit those places. So and then lastly, I just want to know how do you combine your efforts with other quality management systems? Surely I would assume that in the police management there is quality management systems. I know that in education there are various school assessment programs. Old school evaluation is a well-known program. There's NEDU, the National Education Evaluation and Development Unit, etc. Because I think what, if you also, if I may say, I think if you really want to make an impact, you know, people, they get, in Afrikaans, there's the word force. They get fed up with all kinds of people coming and inspecting them, etc. And especially if this one wants a complaints box and the other one wants a register and the other one wants aircon and so on. And then lastly, if I can just ask you, in terms of the standards that you set, do you differentiate in your standards between the waiting time in a clinic and the waiting time in a vehicle testing facility, etc.? Or do you have the same standards across the board? Because I think one must understand that the pressures on these entities may differ quite vastly. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Jefferson. I thank the Minister of Service.
All of us work wouldn't.
Not only for us, but the worker wouldn't. Because the effort that that the department is doing actually represents the aspirations of the politicians. I'm worried about the time it takes between the assessment, the reassessment, and the report to cabinet. Because paramount to the whole exercise is to give effect to the services, and the politician is interested in that to see whether his strategies are being are effective or not. By the time it takes for a report done between during 13-14 and June 15, it looks a bit too long. So can't we find a way, Chair, of reducing the time lapse between the two exercises so that a political intervention comes sooner than we're able to improve on our strategies to deliver? Because at times we might coin a strategy thinking that it's going to have an effect only to have a different effect to what we expected. And how you monitor that depends on the time at which you get your report or your feedback. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. May we first probably start by appreciating the pilot results, which also respond to the NDP aspirations, I think so. But having said that, Chair, you know why the scoring of the that specific police station, the officials are scoring themselves higher than the community? It's because they also attend, when we go for an oversight, they accompany us and they think they're attending a meeting. If there's a public event, they are all there in their numbers. Actually, they end up categorizing themselves as VIP. It's a community meeting, so you will appreciate why they are saying that. I'm sure your School of Governance also will assist for that set of mind so that they can appreciate and understand their core function. As it may, Chair, I heard you. It's Leonard, yeah? It's Jonathan, not Leon. When you're saying that, also you will also, it's not yourself. It's Benedict. It's saying that also we will look at the facility, the cleanliness of the facility. Yeah, cleanliness of the facility and all that in terms of the upkeeping of the facility. balancing that with the service, the quality of the service that is being provided. I think also what you need to look at the facility other than the clinic, the friendliness. I think Honorable McGill raised that one in terms of user-friendly of the facility for people in particular, people living with disability. Because most of our facilities, I bet you, were very slow in terms of addressing that, the accessibility of people with living with disability. Also, the chairperson, my last point will be of a proposal when you are responding to what next, because that is very critical. Because sometimes your department, DPN, MME, they don't appreciate how powerful they are in terms of influencing in fulfilling the aspirations of the NDP and also the SONA within the current year in question at any given time. That you must also forge a very much alive, active relationship with other departments. I know you mentioned COCTA, which also assists us in terms of dealing with the local government, but the offices of the Premier, in terms of their monitoring and evaluation departments, planning and the call planning departments, all that, which we will assist, so that when we make plans, we also were able to cross-check with the budget and the resources thereof, and also other relationship with your CDWs, all those other structures that are in place on the ground, that we need also to interpret those ones so that this one we can have an impact, because we cannot be sitting here to say that we'll give you money. Obviously, the treasurer has also said that they are not going to give you money. Actually, they are going to cut. And how best then you spread, as correctly as raised by other honorable members, that there must be an impact. And also there must be, at least out of what the calculation that honorable may have made, at least 10% of that one you would have covered. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, although the number of departments that have been visited is it's not that much, I don't think that we should look at from the point of view saying that you have only done 700 or 600 departments and there's so many other departments. I think that although it's a small step, Chair, it is a step in the right direction that this government is trying to achieve. Involving citizens, that is crucial to get citizens to make input of where service delivery can take place is crucial, and it's just maybe a small step, but it's a small step in the right direction. But the question I want to know from the department is that when, I know maybe it's an unfair question, when do you actually envisage a full rollout of this program, and especially at the local government level? Because that's the whole phase of service delivery. That's where it's happening. And with COCTA to make sure that we can roll this program out in every province, in every local municipality in the country. But I think that's the starting point that we will need to start with. Thanks.
Thanks, Chairperson. No, one must start by welcoming the report. I think the initiative that has been taken are very good, and the pilot project as well. But although some of my questions have been mostly covered by my colleagues, there is one that I want to emphasize. If you say you have monitored 8 types of frontline service delivery sites, as Honorable McLaughlin said, one would be interested to know, for example, the area and the name of that particular spot, because that might help us as parliamentarians. You might say maybe we have visited, for instance, in case of Nguata River Police Station, that is where I come from. That should assist me also to assist you to make some follow-ups if I'm around there. And also when we plan our oversight, maybe it might assist us to plan to go and check the developments where we have already done this kind of an assessment. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks.
I think the Public Service Commission has also conducted a citizen-based monitoring, and there's a report. What is your relationship with them? And then whether what they are doing, are you not duplicating? Are there no duplications? You know, because part of what we trying to do is to try and use resources quite effectively, and by all means avoid duplication. Tucson centers. What is your involvement in Tucson centers? Because I've seen in one of your slides, SASA is rated very low because of non-visibility. And we have conducted oversight. We've gone to Tucson centers, but when we get there, they are next to the people, they are accessible, but they do not have resources. They are not resourced. So if you're not doing any work there, I would request that you start focusing on that. I think members spoke quite very strongly about follow-up. How do we then make people feel that what they have raised has been taken into account? Who responds and what is the response time? Well, we appreciate that you are still starting, especially the second presentation, the citizen-based monitoring. But do you have capacity? You know, that's a question that I like asking most departments when they present. Do you have capacity? And what you're doing, is it sustainable? And how do you see that improving service delivery and in particular the lives of the people? Thanks. While you're still thinking, I've seen photos of young people participating there. How do you recruit them? And what is their level of qualification? Because we also have, as this department, we have to monitor on the recruitment of 20,000 young graduates per annum. Are they community-based? And if you move from that community going to another community, are you still going to train others, or you'll be still be using the same? And then if not, then those that you have trained, then where are they supposed to go? Where, you know? Because once you give me a temporary job like that, you know, already you've raised hopes, their expectations that as and when the pilot is expanding or is growing, I might get an opportunity. But if it is then community-based, sustainability of those young people, how do you then carry them through? Okay, you may respond. Just thought, that's a question.
Chairperson, at times I think there is a possibility that what you come up with to the community, that this is how things are done, or in your engagement with them, it's not necessarily what might the community see as an ideal thing. Are there such conflicting situations, and how do you deal with them? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. The acting DDG, Mr. Ntakumba, has also joined us, so he will also assist with the question.
You're welcome, DDG.
I will start with the resources and money question. There was a number of questions asked. I don't have an exact, we don't do activity budgeting yet in the department for this project. I think after 3 years we should be able to do some calculation of how much it costs per visit. I don't have that. But what I can say is that the team that does this field monitoring, the 650 facilities, the budget for that program, including me, which does more than just that, is about 10 million a year, and will not be growing more than that. And it's a very expensive exercise to be in the field and to travel and to continuously go back. And we actually have to start lowering the number. We will never be able to do more than we're doing now. As the cost increases, our budget is not going to increase, so we have to actually slow down and start doing less new visits so that we're able to do more improvement monitoring, because we can't do both. So it's about 10 million for that program. The citizen-based monitoring, we have virtually no budget. We have a 2 million rand budget. And that is really, we have a team of two people. We started the program up. We have requested funding to start building the team and drive the pilot, but we were not successful. In the last year and a half of the pilot, we have used donor funding. We had different funding, which is now ending in September, and that we really used to drive the pilot. And then we have an in-house team of two people for that. So in terms of the future of citizen-based monitoring, also the way we've explained the pilot, honorable members will see that it's very resource-intensive. You don't go in, ask people to fill in a survey and walk. It's a lot of conversations and staying around and engaging with people, engaging with the leadership and making people feel comfortable. We don't see that as ever being something we will do at scale as CPME. But what we are very anxious is to get to a point where we can start writing up models and how to train community surveyors and how to develop these surveys and how to do the analysis. And we think that is possibly something that we will contribute that needs to then be used by other departments. Going back to the beginning of the questions, the Minister of DPSA went to visit frontline staff. We also have not seen the report yet, but we do know that the Minister chose to make his focus frontline staff to go and talk about the morale based on the findings from our frontline service delivery visit monitoring, and he even said that in when he announced that he will be going into the field, because we have highlighted to DPSA that continuously we think a major risk to anything we do, whether we put more money into frontline service delivery or better buildings, remains the staff and their morale, and unless we do something about that. So we've highlighted that, and I think possibly contributed to the Minister going to speak to staff to find out what is it that is making them to be so unhappy, and what is it that they will need to get on board and contribute, to be part of the transformation of service delivery. And we have not seen that report yet. The second issue is about too many tools for monitoring, that we're focusing a lot on SASSA and the police and SAPS, and what about COCTA? We chose those eight types of facilities because we thought that in the daily life of any South African, those are the types of places where they are most likely to experience government, home affairs, the police, SASSA, health facility. Every single South African would engage with that. And the experience they have when they go there will influence how they feel about government as a whole. The way they experience home affairs will be the way they judge government. But there are many other places. We then, 2 years ago, we realized we should focus on local government as well. But we then chose municipal customer care centers as an entry point. So one of the eight types of facilities we monitor is municipal customer care centers. And the other facility where we do interact with local government a lot is the license centres, because in many of the towns, the license centres are actually managed by municipalities. They have agency agreements with the provinces, but they are responsible for that. But those are really the only two places. And then the question about Tusong service centres. When we visit a SASSA office in a town, if the SASSA facility is in a Tusong service, so you might see, you know, Greater Tibati SASSA, but it's actually located in the Tusong service centre often. So, and the same with home affairs and so on. So we do engage with the Tusong service centres, but from the perspective of what specific service they are offering. But the Honourable Chairperson might be aware that there has been an evaluation underway of Tusong service centres, driven by GPSA, supported by the Government Technical Advisory Service in the National Treasury. They had a project team, and by now they must have a report. I'm sure there must be an outcome of that. That evaluation was to relook at the whole business model of Tusong service centres, and we shared with them our experiences from the front lines of the delivery. And our main experience was how the complexities that is being caused by the fact that the Tusong service centres might have a manager that is a municipal employee, and then you have four or five different national service departments in it, and they feel that relationship between the head of SASSA in the Tusong service centre and the head of the facility, which is a municipal employee, is often fraught with tension, and SASSA feels they cannot instruct that municipal employee about improvements they need to their condition, which often sometimes results in SASSA leaving the Tusong service centre. In the worst case scenario, they leave the Tusong service centre and go and seek their own facility, because they feel they can then control the condition, whereas it's more difficult for them. But there has been an evaluation ongoing, maybe one possibility is for the committee to ask to get a presentation on the findings of that evaluation that has just been done recently on Tusong service centres.
We're raising this because now recently in January we've just conducted oversight. And well, we'll await for the report, but given an opportunity and time, we would want to visit all Tusong centres across the country. But the ones that we have visited, they're not up to standard. So, yeah, we'll await for the report.
Yes, the report is being, the evaluation is led by GPSA, and I know part of the methodology of doing that evaluation was also visiting a very large sample of the Tusong service centres, which I think that they have actually done. From where we're sitting, our experience is one of the big challenges is that relationship between who the owner is of the Tusong service centre, the building, which is often the municipality, and then departments being located there, coming from a culture where a municipality and the SASSA head office often don't have any relationship, and here they are suddenly having to work together for the better of the facility. And often they don't have control over how the municipality invests the revenue from that facility. And often in municipalities, you're not allowed to do ring fencing of funding. So it's not like the money generated from the Tusong Service Centre or the license centre can be ring fenced for investment in that license centre. Often the funding goes into a pot that is used for other things. There was a general question about what happens when we see bad results at facility level, and what power do we have to influence that. We have said before that we, as a department, we are not able to instruct Home Affairs what to do. We're not able to instruct any other department. And the methodology that we follow is really about relationships. That's all that we can do. We, I think we are lucky that many people in our department are people who have been civil servants for quite a few years. They have very good linkages in the civil service. We know most people who are in senior positions. We've worked with them somewhere else in government. And most people in our department come from that kind of a background. So it is, we use our relationships to get access to the head of SASSA. If we find anything in the field, we're able to go very senior and very high up. For example, we meet with the Commissioner of Police on a regular basis about frontline service delivery and CDF and the presidential hotline. She has a particular interest in these things, and we don't have a challenge having regular access to her as a senior person. And we have that with, I think, most of the departments, and that helps us. But that is really, you know, there's no science behind it. It's really just about using our relationships with departments and building relationships of trust. They know that we will not, you know, report publicly about things that we have found without giving them the opportunity. So we make sure that we don't, you know, we always give them the opportunity to know what we found and give them an opportunity to resolve challenges before we report further on. So that is really all that we are using. Jonathan, can I hand over to you to talk a little bit more about the CBM specific question?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The reference to Palama. Oh,
sorry. Just before I hand over to you, I wanted to just highlight the kind of reports that we can make available to the committee. The question was, you should really know which facilities were visited, which facilities have been revisited, and what were the findings. So this is the kind of database that we have of every single facility, what was the date that we did the visit, and what were the findings. And then there's a similar one for the improvement facility. And that we will, it's a big database, not quite easy to print, but we will give it to the committee secretariat on a stick, and they can make this available. The same with CBM. What are the names of facilities we have visited, and where we know which are the next pilot facilities, we will also make that available. The exact findings from CBM, we don't make that publicly available yet because we are still in the process of discussing those findings. But the names of the facilities we are working in, absolutely. The names of the facilities we are planning to go to unannounced, like in 1560, that is confidential because it's supposed to be unannounced visits. And the reason we try to not make that known, the visits we're going to do this coming year, is because it makes a huge difference. When you walk into a facility, we will know within the first few seconds whether they knew we were coming. You immediately know whether people knew you were coming, and it affects the results. So keeping that a little bit as much as we can, I think. So this big database, even before we leave the meeting, before we go back, we will make this available to the secretary.
Thank you. So the first question relating to Palama and School of Government. And the reference in the framework to collaborating with training and capacity building institutions. First of all, what is emerging from the pilot is the need to build, our thinking at the moment is that identifying a need to build a cadre of people who can facilitate solution-seeking dialogue in government. There seems to be, I mean, one of the things that we come up against a lot, and I think all of us will be very familiar with it, is a very hierarchical culture within the public service and within society more generally. And it can be well described in terms of a ranks and hierarchy. So more junior people are not encouraged to voice their opinions or views, and there's a lot of what we have noticed in our engagement. There's a lot of putting the blame elsewhere. So there's not a lot of agency that we're coming across. The problems are all, you know, we are doing the best we can in the given circumstances, but unless you give us more resources, more people, there's nothing we can do. We're doing the best we can. So there's this, external locus of control, which is quite prevalent. And really what we identify is the need to be able to facilitate conversations, to say, okay, given the limited options that you may see for yourself, what still is your role within this? Can you request support? Can you identify what can you do within your control? So we have had discussions with DPSA, which have included School of Government people, around what are the practices and methodologies that are available. One of the areas that we've been exploring is some of the practices that are used quite extensively in manufacturing and operations management, such as lean and the kind of philosophies around creating self-learning and systems that emphasize the problem-solving abilities of people rather than turning people as into simple functionaries of a system. So, you know, there's a whole body of knowledge, both internationally and locally, that we are starting to try and draw on. We've arranged for, together with the Lean Institute Africa at the UCT, attached to UCT Business School, to expose officials in DPME and in all the offices of the Premier. Well, Office of the Premier inviting various officials to be exposed to a two-day training course around using lean principles in problem solving. So this whole area of building problem solving and agency within the civil service, I think, is something that we would like to work increasingly with School of Government to look at how do you massify this, and we've identified some opportunities, but it's really the need to take it further. In terms of the lack of political or bureaucratic support, criticisms, sensitivities, the process that we follow when we give feedback and develop responses to the feedback takes into account the resistances that will be not to be expected. So while we have very positive explicit support for this, there's often when we start to address systemic underlying issues, they challenge status quo often, they challenge relationships, they challenge power relationships, and then you see a more subtle form of resistance. But they're not explicit. And that again, I think the opportunity is for people to see the value to them for changing. As long as they see this as being imposed or from outside, there are a lot of strategies that people will use within their system. So if you take a clinic or a police station, there are well-established strategies of resistance to maintain status quo. And I think any external intervention needs to be able to understand those dynamics and try and win everyone over to see the benefits. We've seen some wonderful examples of how when people are given voice and given expression and given the opportunity to, first of all, to state the problem, to say what's actually going on, without being in a punitive context. People are very fearful in the civil service. There's a strong sense of being held responsible even if you're not given the resources. So it becomes sometimes very frustrating where you are a victim of other parts of the system, but yet you are held accountable. And there's a cruelty in that. And so this, especially the processes that we are wanting to work with School of Government and Palama around, is how do you get people to be excited about solving problems? How do you get to see their own abilities to think and solve problems being valued? Again, I think the questions that you asked are leading again to these, the relational nature of many systems. So the social, cultural, and political obstacles to people participating and giving their views. It's not the examples that you gave, but I'll give a little example of how, in the first phase, we gave opportunity to officials to give their views. We used a certain approach. So we gave each official, we had the forms in envelopes, and each official was given, we held a meeting of staff to introduce, and each staff member was given their own survey to fill out, and then we had a box. So two things happened then. We got very low response rates, okay? And the responses were very negative. So if you looked at the graphs, all red, okay? Very small sample. So low participation and very negative. We did a different approach in the second phase where we, because of the poor levels of compliance, we requested the management team to communicate and manage the response. We got high levels of compliance and we got extraordinarily positive responses uniformly. Everyone said, no, managers are fantastic. Really, there's no problems in this facility. So it just gave a real insight into how you, kind of the relationship and the perceived power relations in that process and how people's responses. So we use our surveying approach is to use people that are independent of the facility that is being monitored. So we use we have an NPO, not-for-profit organization, that we have contracted to be a sort of implementing partner. And then certainly at the community level, they perform certain parts of the process, and they're well-suited. So someone described citizen-based monitoring as a dance between civil society and government. Each needs to play their part, but they can't play each other's part. So the surveyors are community. And that, I think, we, you know, that kind of, and the training they get is to encourage people to give expression. The surveys are anonymous, so we try and address those questions of an anonymity, of trust, of perception. But obviously, you know, people are always going to be reading the situation for threat, and some of the data needs to be taken with that kind of analytical eye. You know, sometimes you look at but you look at paradoxes in the data. So you have, what you had was, in some of the staff feedback, you had data that was very positive about management, yet some other parts of data, like, for example, would you recommend this as a facility to work to someone that you knew, then it's very different. So really the data as an opportunity to have discussions, to make sense. We're not saying this data is the gospel truth and we're going to... What does the data mean? Yes, data is fallible. So it's about trying to encourage critical thinking, and that not to be afraid of asking questions, of having different views, but what is the process socially that you come to a response? The time frames for the pilot, we run the pilot till end of September. We have an evaluation that's looking at the phase of all the different phases. We're looking at phase one and phase two as completed cycles, and then so we will have an evaluation completed by September, which will hopefully give us the elements of a strategy moving forward. And we've had ongoing relationships and discussions with the sectors that we are participating with. So we have a steering committee for each of the sectors that we report our findings from each of the pilot cycles. We engage with a number of different platforms. So in terms of interactions with staff, we present to the Board of Commissioners, we're presenting to the top 1,500 meeting on Friday. We We engage with provincial commissioners on specific issues. In terms of indicators of police, of the policing survey, we really focused a lot on a set of engagements with the, with pilot communities to inform the kinds of questions we're asking. I think there's probably moving forward opportunity to revisit the safety and security chapter of the NDP and see where. But nothing is fixed. You know, it's really the approach that we're taking is what is the utility of the approach. It's, I think we acknowledge that a system-wide data system is not actually going to produce what we require. So it's the uniqueness and specificity of each cycle. I hope that satisfies all the
surveying team. How do we recruit them?
Yes. Okay. So in the first phase, we recruited the survey teams from the community work program participants. So we our criteria are not university graduates. We made the criteria matric, and we worked through the community work program. The second phase, we chose sites that didn't have community work program, and we recruited them variously from Department of Social Development, from lists of unemployed people that social development had developed through Project Mikongo, through door-to-door. We worked with ward committees who had lists of people. We acknowledged that any kind of recruitment, any work opportunity at a community level can rapidly become the site of conflict and struggle. So our strategy was to convene a survey planning team of multiple different stakeholders. So we brought different people into that meeting to discuss and debate how we would form the survey teams. And each local site had its own dynamics. But what we wanted to strive for was inclusion, so that we wouldn't have people blocking the process on the ground. The team is local. It's not a team that we then train and give opportunities from place to place. I acknowledge that we create hope and expectation through this. It is just a once-off work experience. We are trying to avoid creating expectations that this will be a work opportunity. The attraction of the community work program is that this just becomes a work stream in their useful work, so the participants get 2 days of work a week, 8 days of work a month. So we could build a team of monitors within the 1,500 participants of our community work site, and those 40 people could then be available to Stats SA, to market research, and it could create a career opportunity. But the once-off, in terms of the pilot, really, it's for some people it's been the first work experience they've had. We were requested to provide names through our process to a further training opportunity for citizen journalists through Health eNews, which is focusing on developing citizen journalist capacity around health issues. So we were able to forward those names. It was just two people. But what was very exciting was to see that certificate being, except for the matric certificate, of someone who had very good matric results from Singa in her early 20s. The only other qualification she had was that certificate. And this isn't, I don't think this can be seen as a, I mean, yeah, it's...
Blackfish volunteers model? There's a different version of the pilot that is actually run quite independent of us by an NGO, Blackfish. And we have a long-standing relationship with them, but they source their own funding, donor funding. We have an agreement, a service-level agreement, that they would use more or less the same model, the same questionnaires, the same analysis, and then we have facilitated access for them to certain sites, such as facilities, police stations, and they are doing this monitoring using volunteer, community volunteers that they've trained themselves, and they give them a stipend. And the reason we are facilitating or supporting that is because that almost at the end of it is what is a more realistic model, where this is run independently by civil society, and we are working with police and SASA to make sure that when they have these engagements with citizens, that they have the skills and the capabilities to listen, to respond, and to have engagements with citizens where they receive the information, they process it, and they act on it, and they feedback, which is not happening.
I get it first that you're trying to distance yourself from, or not trying to, you don't want to make any commitment of job creation in what you're doing. I get that feeling. Remember, monitoring evaluation, it's quite labor, intensive. It needs people because it's about people policing other people. So it will involve a lot of people. So it's not an issue that we can resolve now, but I'm just saying bear that in mind. Because if you guys can plan properly, you also have an opportunity to at least create employment opportunities for young graduates, for matriculants, in all areas where you're going, because it's about sustaining your programs. You don't want to go into an area then 2 weeks later we see on TV they've been hit by a service delivery protest. Wherever you've been involved, we want to see good practices, good governance practices. So I'm saying just bear that in mind. In your planning somehow, try and see how best you can then make sure that when you go to areas, the people that you train, either you take them to other areas or you let them work in that area, you know. It's nothing to be worried about or to be afraid of. It's within your right, because monitoring and evaluation, it's people-based, it's labor-intensive. It brings me to the issue of social media. How have you ever thought of using that as one of the models? Because of now everybody's on Twitter, on Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram, and so I think that's another cheapest and effective way of engaging communities, because dynamics are different in different areas. I just want to check if you've also explored that.
Well, Chairperson, if I can just respond to that question around social media. Yes, there are huge technological opportunities. You know, the current wave of information communication technology offers so much potential for open government, for government being able to communicate with its citizens and for citizens to communicate with the government. On the other hand, it can be a bit of a trap, because it offers so much potential, but there are many teething troubles to be found along the way. So in our research, we were initially, like many other parallel initiatives, had a technology focus. But what we've emphasized certainly during the pilot is the relational part. And some of the unexpected risks. For example, the survey teams in our first site said, "No, we don't want to use smartphones or tablets or anything like that, because that gets stolen. We want to use paper. We don't feel safe going around." So I think what you're referencing is what is termed as a crowdsourcing approach to monitoring, where people provide the feedback on their own initiative. That's a huge area of opportunity, and we're working with a number of initiatives like Making All Voices Count program, which is looking at how to bring some of the ratings technology to rate government facilities, and they're producing reports. And we're working closely with keeping our eye and working with them on that. But our approach was, how do we use existing opportunities within the government system to get that feedback happening, and how do we most importantly start encourage an attitude both within community and government to be curious about what people think and what people experience, and not to say success, we can only report success, but let's talk about what is rather than what should be, and then how do we move from here to there rather than this punishing idea of not meeting the target all the time, which can be quite disempowering. I think it comes to that other point of people being afraid of authority and not feeling able to freely express their views. And I think that is a profound observation. And I think there's so much historical context in that observation. And the writings of Mahmoud Mamdani, Citizen and Subject, describing the impact of the indirect rule there's so much about that. The techniques we use to address that are in the way we so some of them are in the way we design the meetings. So we don't have the officials up on a podium and the people down on the ground. We're constantly refining and observing how this works. You know, in one community report back meeting, we observed that it took 110 minutes for 11 people to voice their questions, and the bulk of that was officials talking and giving the correct answer. So in the following one, in another town, what we did was we divided the community meeting up into four groups, and they circulated around this hall. And then we had stations that were a police area, a Sata area, and we facilitated that discussion independently of the officials. And the way they were seated was as a group, and the discussions were around seeking solutions. So I think it's just through the experience that starts to shift. But I think it's a national.
Can I just bring something? Members, you're free to do that as well. Would you consider going to areas where there've been challenges of service delivery protests? Would you consider to immediately go to such areas? I'm just asking that because I think areas where they've experienced serious service delivery protests, you know, they would need that type of engagement, rebuilding of the society and the community, because after a service delivery protest, you know, people just basically lose confidence in government. Malamulere, for an example, even though they are fighting for municipality demarcation, but you know, it's not everybody's fighting for that. Others are frustrated about SASA, the police and all that. Now they had an opportunity to just raise their frustrations through protest. So I'm just thinking aloud, because if this model used properly, and if you would be given the resources and the support that you require, I don't see us having service delivery protests in the country. Because people's issues, you know, will be dealt with immediately, and in the executive will be held accountable. So, yeah. Members, are there any follow-up issues? All right. Okay.
May I attempt a response? I think the first thing is to realize that this is not a quick fix. This is about relationships, and it's about agency, and it's about transformation. That said, I do agree that if one could identify a key improvement that makes sense to the people in a community that have had conflict, if you could choose one or two things, for example, if water, reliable water supply, was a touch point for people, and you introduced and you came up with that indicator through a dialogue process, through different partners, and said, well, we can't fix everything, but let's choose one thing, and let's walk the journey together. And then let the community monitor the milestones. and build a monitoring process around something that is quite symbolic and powerful. I think you could really begin to use a process like this to rebuild trust, because people are sick of empty promises. And the instinct of government to go and solve a critical problem may just perpetuate that, because sometimes the issues are not just solved by issuing an order or a command. So I think this participatory, dialogue-driven process where you identify something quite specific can build the capacity within the community and the system more broadly to respond to bigger challenges. The implementing partner that we've been working with is running a process in Bekkersdal, independent of the work they're doing with us. So they are working with the many different stakeholders, the parliament, the councillors, the municipality, and they're running a process called Organization Workshop. It's a particular methodology that runs over 8 weeks. It's funded by the Mines. They were approached by the Mines. And they basically, this Organization Workshop focuses on building community organizational capacity through doing something. So it's very dialogue-driven, but the result is a community project that they collectively achieve together. And there's all sorts of theory behind this and how it addresses conflict. But in that discussion, because they've been intimately involved in the development and piloting of the citizen-based monitoring, they proposed that, especially in their discussions with the municipal manager of Western Area, the question was how do we build this relationship? Because they've basically lost control of Bekkersdal in some ways, and it's been held by a, as you know, and so the proposal was to use citizen-based monitoring to first set indicators that mattered for the community, and then to monitor them and to hold the municipality accountable for some things. So we've got this, I'm not sure where that's going to run, but we've got a kind of a test case, the potential for a test case to watch how this works, which we can report back to the committee if they do implement.
Maybe the short answer would be, do we, you know, can we go in and facilitate these kind of discussions? And the short answer would be no, not us. But there are, and also to understand, when we're talking about all of this work we've been doing, it's not us personally that's doing. We are very lucky that we managed to find in the private sector, but they are specialists in working with communities. We don't have that specialization. And I think, to be honest, I don't know if it really exists that much in the public service anymore. We have to rebuild those skills of how to have meaningful conversations with civil society. We found these people and we have employed them to work on our behalf, and they are doing all of these facilitations. So to massify this and go further, we can if we can continue having the resources to be able to bring in people who are specialists in this and have experience in it, to facilitate these kinds of conversations.
Okay. Are there any outstanding issues? Michael?
I'm still not satisfied with the response on the unit role in municipalities where there's warning signals. Are they playing a role, like I've explained, where municipalities have, for instance, 6 months ago a problem, and 6 months later it exploded? And if there's a role for this body to play, then yes, we are going somewhere, unlike being reactive.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. We do have close engagements with the local government stakeholders through the MDP implementation program. That's outcome 11 So it's in two parts. The actual outcome is about the whole range of issues, including back to basics program. And we play that role of facilitating that. The national COCTA and the provincial COCTAs have enough capacity to drive implementation at the local level. And then the second part is where we realize that this sphere of government is actually, there is more problems than Mr. I. Hence, then we started a different program which we call Local Government Management Improvement Model, which although we assess the municipality itself, its management capacity in various dimensions, we also include service delivery aspects to that. So, in a sense, then we have a mechanism of assessing how the municipalities are doing their work. Clearly, there are issues that would need more real-time kind of early warning. I think we should accept that, like Bernadette has said, it's something that would require even much more bigger kind of expertise. The approach as well is to really make sure that those who are already involved, the SALGAs, provincial COCTAs, are able to work as partners rather than us duplicating their existing capacity. So where does the citizen-based monitoring and evaluation program comes in? We come in now from that entry point that has been well explained by my colleagues of really bringing the voice of the citizen into the play. But the local government issues are quite more complex because, for example, it's not only COCTA. You have about four sectors that are active in that sector, like your electricity, you have housing now coming into play and all of that. So there is a way that we are engaging those stakeholders to make sure that's happening. There is another question maybe that was asked before that I would like maybe to quickly add to the one of the reporting cycle. The annual reporting cycle is more the accountability one, where we would have a date specified, say, in the cabinet or cabinet committee that we will come and report. But in between those periods, our own political principals are either directly involved in the unannounced visits, or they would make requests for some for reports about what's happening on the ground. And that is done quite regularly and on request. There are other forums where we already have a standing agenda item around the presidential outline, frontline service delivery monitoring, and citizen-based monitoring. For example, the Presidential Coordinating Council, where President meets with the provinces and also some of the offices of the Premier. The fact that we work very closely with the offices of the Premier and the provincial sectoral departments makes us to also be able to share the findings quite frequently with the various structures at different levels. Now, the intervention part, whilst we acknowledge that we're not very strong at it, the improvement monitoring seeks to do exactly that. Because we have done the unannounced visit, then produced a report to the management that this is what we've seen, it's not going right, so we would like, when we come back, that this is fixed. But then what we do, we make follow-ups, especially where there would be a need, for example, like Bernadette says, alert the National South African Police Service that something isn't going well at a certain facility. It could be, from our observation, this might be a systematic issue. What do you do about it? They either acknowledge that even through their own systems, they have fixed something like that, but because now we bring in that voice of an external, independent voice of DPME, they are able to prioritize those issues on the ground. So thank you, Honorable Chair.
To raise this, but I think Honorable McGlue is raising this issue, the same issue that I'm keep on raising, and there's not really a direct response we're getting to it. I think let's just forget about the SEPs, Home Affairs. Let's take all of that out of mind. Let us, because it seems like this committee and members of this committee are saying very, very clearly that the problem is lying, service delivery problem, where our problem lies is at local government. and we should speak to them. We want to hear what program or what's your vision on actually going into that terrain of local government. And whilst I'm saying that, shouldn't SELGA be involved? Shouldn't SELGA be involved in this process too? Have you all made contact with SELGA? Has SELGA been brought on board? Because that is where the real problem lies. We go out here. We have knocked on people's doors. All these politicians sitting have knocked on people's doors last year, 2014. And every complaint that we've got, we never had so much complaint about national government. Our complaint was local government, local issue. And that's where the problem lies. We need to fix it. And even now, too, we can see the service delivery protests and stuff like that. We've got a total breakdown of communication between local councillors and communities where citizens are not consulted, where there's no communication, where there's just chaos there at that level, and that's where we should fix it. So if we can perhaps just talk about local government, what are your plans to sort it out, and the issue of SELGA, has SELGA been consulted on this matter, are they on board or what?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. We note the point, and we will make sure there is follow-up. And it could be we might have to then call in the program that deals straight with local government and advise them to also bring along some of the key stakeholders, SELGA, and probably the National Cocktail, because there is quite massive amount of work that's happening at that level, so that these questions can be adequately answered. And we are happy as well to bring in more detail around the citizen-based monitoring just the dimension of local government, because as we prepare the presentation to be more comprehensive about this strategy rather than picking on directly how we engage with local government. And there are very excellent kind of cases that we can show. But the gap definitely, Honorable Member, is there. We accept that. Thank you.
All right. I think we should thank you for the presentation, and this is work in progress. We're looking forward to hearing from you again. But you know, as you were presenting, I could hear a whisper in my ears that indeed the people shall govern as stipulated by the Freedom Charter. tell me, what did you study, Tim?
I studied literature and history, followed by journalism.
Oh, the Dumdau.
But mostly at the University of Life.
Okay, all right. Yeah, all right. No, thank you very much for the passion as well. It's unfortunate. You know, at some point we just have to call Treasury and ask them what is it that they have against this ministries. Because we cannot expect this ministry to tighten their belt, you know. That's where they... we cannot expect them to do that, you know, to cut their budgets, and we want service delivery to be expedited. And if we're saying such a department to cut its budget, and it's just not right. But we'll find a way of engaging with Treasury at some point. All right. Well, thank you very much. Members, let's just take 2 minutes break, then deal with the minutes. I'm sure it will just take us less than 5 minutes to deal with the minutes, ne? Hey, quite a number. From June last year, yeah. Welcome back. Now let's deal with the minutes as agreed. We will start 25th of June 2014. Are there corrections? By the way, Parliament meeting, they don't have matters arising. Because what are you going to raise? But going forward, I don't want us to approve minutes like this. I want us to at least approve minutes in each and every meeting or two meetings. Last week? Oh, yeah. That's how we're supposed to. Okay. A mover? Seconder? Dao? Done? 2nd July? Ntombela was there? Ntombela is moving. Derek was there? Seconder? 9 July. Ntombela was there. Mekluwa was there. Shop shop. 20th August. Mutau. Kado. Not Kado. Dev. Sorry, Dev. 10th. September. Yep. September. Oh, this month, September. Before September. Okay. Let them go. Maglua, you're also there. Maglua. 17th September. Derek Smooth. Oh, okay. We have movers and shakers here. 21st October.
I'm worried.
Mm. You're not the, your name is not on the list. There's someone who signs the register for you. October 21st. That's the Mutau. Ntombela, second. 22nd October. Ntombela was there. Mendes never absent in my meetings. She's always there. Just like you. But in fact, all of you members. Yeah, the attendance is quite good here. Yeah. I could see that all of you. October 22nd. Oh, done. Sorry, I was sleeping. Now the 29th October. The Tentombela. Mamento. Is the magma.
Before we continue from this one, we have an outstanding issue. Did we receive their responses? Because they never responded to a lot of issues, and they were supposed to send us the responses on writing.
Okay, okay. Let's do this. Remember the subcommittees? I also looked at some issues here. They're still outstanding. Let's then take all the issues there to the subcommittees. Because it is now the duty of the subcommittees to process everything that is outstanding.
No,
so part of the minutes and corrections and any other thing can then come through the subcommittee meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to work. Okay. 29th. Okay. Also, sorry, you appear as apology and as on. All right, sorry. 5th of November. Okay. 11th November. Can we get a mover and a seconder? Okay. My crew was not there. Mente was there. Dambela was there. Vestazen is not here. And Lesoma. Mente, are you helping us? Shosha. 19th November. You are back in action. Okay, 19th November. Derek's is Mutau. Oh. Okay, 18 February. Yeah, this is how it's supposed to work now. This is recent, it's fine. 18 February. Last week. Dombela was present. Kado, Maglua, Matau, Mente. Okay, Datem Tau. On Dombela, second. Okay, sharp. For the first 10, so how many meetings did you have?
This
10. The past 10. How many meetings? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I think we've done well. Yeah? Yeah, we've done well. I think we've done well because we also had a strategic plan. We also conducted the oversight, which the report will then be tabled in our next portfolio committee meeting for approval. Ne? We'll send copies prior to that. And then we'll then decide whether we just want to table it or we want to debate it in the House. I hope they will have give us a slot should we go the route of debating. Okay.
Can I address one issue?
Yeah, sure.
It's regarding our oversight. I'm not too sure, but forgive me on the criteria being used visiting the Eastern Cape. I would really like us, when we have oversight in the future, that we do like a think tank together and that us as a committee go out and do that type of oversight. I like the idea what the previous presenters have said here, you know, regarding unannounced. And then for us not preventing to do oversight when people are awaiting us and be prepared and dish up some nice stuff for us. We would rather prefer us doing it and make a decision. And perhaps it's not to expose departments or organizations, but if for instance a member of parliament comes here from a specific province, we know that they have normally problems with NIDA in this area and the distance and all of that. And then he can perhaps motivate that case and we go there. And should there be problems, I think the sole purpose of that oversight budget will then also be to assist those people to enhance and to excel, you know, as far as the shortages there. But we must prevent going to people that is already some ready fixed stuff for us and all of that. I was just thinking aloud, Chair.
Also, in addition, the suggestion we had on our way back from KZN about the debate of our report, that can't we wait to debate our report at least having visited at least half of Tusong Center so that we can have a broader information and knowledge of how do these Tusong Centers look like?
Second suggestion.
Just a point on, I know we're not discussing it, but it's just we're not discussing our oversight visit. On page 14, I see the committee observations. We are saying that we, members of parliament, were satisfied and impressed. I would suggest that we take out the satisfied but leave the impressed, you know, because satisfied with what? Yes, yes, in the report. I think it'll be fair to say the members of parliament were impressed, because if you say satisfied, I don't. It, yeah, yeah, that's why I said I just want just for the secretaries to note that. Yeah, yeah. Indeed, indeed, indeed. It's just something I thought I'd flag. Yeah. Good. Mhm. Possibly, maybe, or but then let us know. It will be in the agenda.